will always retain a certain mystery because by definition it generates things that have not yet been seen or experienced. But we do know that the sort of focus and effort that give rise to expertise also characterize the work of those pioneers who move beyond where anyone has been before. A psychologist who studied the Scrabble abilities of Nigel Richards called this the Nigel effect. The appearance of Richards on the Scrabble scene and his amazing success in tournaments, he has won about 75% of all tournament games he has played, an incredibly high number for anyone who plays regularly against the world's best, showed other Scrabble players what could be achieved in their game. Until Richards came along, no one realized it was possible to be this good, and it forced other Scrabble players to look for ways to increase their own skill levels. No one knows exactly how Richards became so good. He is notoriously uninterested in talking about his training techniques or strategies. But part of it is clearly that he knows more words than any of his competitors. Other Scrabble players are working to catch up, either by memorizing lots of words themselves or with some other approach that neutralizes his advantage. At this writing, Richards is still on top. But over time, his peers will inevitably devise techniques to match and even surpass him, and the field will have moved forward. That's how it always is. The creative, the restless, and the driven are not content with the status quo, and they look for ways to move forward, to do things that others have not. And once a pathfinder shows how something can be done, others can learn the technique and follow. Even if the pathfinder doesn't share the particular technique, as is the case with Richards, simply knowing that something is possible drives others to figure it out. Progress is made by those who are working on the frontiers of what is known and what is possible to do, not by those who haven't put in the effort needed to reach that frontier. In short, in most cases, and this is especially true in any well-developed area, we must rely on the experts to move us forward. Fortunately for all of us, that's what they do best. Chapter 8. But what about natural talent? Whenever I write or speak about deliberate practice and expertise, I am invariably asked, "But what about natural talent?" In my articles and my talks, I always offer the same basic message that I have here. Expert performers develop their extraordinary abilities through years and years of dedicated practice, improving step by step in a long, laborious process. There are no shortcuts. Various sorts of practice can be effective, but the most effective of all is deliberate practice. Deliberate practice takes advantage of the most natural adaptability of the human brain and body to create new abilities. Most of these abilities are created with the help of detailed mental representations, which allow us to analyze and respond to situations much more effectively than we could otherwise. Fine, some people will reply, we understand all that. But even so, aren't there some people who don't have to work as hard and can still be better than everyone else? And aren't there some people who are born without talent for something, say music or math or sports, so that no matter how hard they try, they'll never be any good at it? It is one of the most enduring and deep-seated of all beliefs about human nature that natural talent plays a major role in determining ability. This belief holds that some people are born with natural endowments that make it easier for them to become outstanding athletes or musicians or chess players or writers or mathematicians or whatever. While they may still need a certain amount of practice to develop their skills, they need far less than others who are not as talented, and they can ultimately reach much greater heights. My studies of experts point to quite a different explanation of why some people ultimately develop greater abilities in an area than others, with deliberate practice playing the starring role. So let's separate myth from reality by exploring the intertwined roles of talent and training in the development of extraordinary abilities. As we'll see, innate characteristics play a much smaller and much different role than many people generally assume. The Magic of Paganini. Niccolo Paganini was the greatest violinist of his era, But even for him, the story that got told and retold over the years seemed impossible to believe. Depending on which version of the story one hears, the venue was a packed concert hall or an outdoor space where Paganini was serenading a lady at the request of her gentleman friend. But the basic details remain the same. Paganini was nearing the end of an exquisite piece, with the audience, hundreds of concertgoers, or perhaps just one very lucky lady, caught up in its beauty, unaware of anything else, when one of the violin's four strings snapped. Violin strings in those days, 2 centuries ago, were made from the intestines of sheep and more likely to give way than today's strings. And as Paganini had been approaching the climax of the composition, the poor string couldn't stand up to his forceful playing. The audience was stricken, sad to see the sudden end of the piece, when to their relief, Paganini kept playing. The beauty of the piece was no less on 3 strings than it had been on 4. Then a 2nd string snapped, and again he didn't stop. This time the audience's relief was mixed with disbelief. How could he coax that beautiful melody out of just 2 strings? The dexterity and flexibility required of the fingers on his playing hand were more than the audience imagined was possible for any musician, yet the sound did not suffer. Paganini's playing on 2 strings was superior to what any other violinist could offer with 4. And then, you guessed it, a 3rd string broke. Yet Paganini was undaunted. He finished the piece on the 1 remaining string, his fingers a blur and the audience amazed. I heard this tale from my father when I was about 10 years old, and it seemed to me that if indeed Paganini had been able to do what the story said, he must have been born with some inexplicable capacity that was very rare, perhaps even unique to him. Later in life, after I'd been studying deliberate practice for some years, I still remembered my father's story, and I set out to track down the details in order to understand how such a feat might have been possible. The first thing you discover when you read about Paganini is that he was truly a groundbreaking violinist. He developed a number of new techniques that allowed him to play the violin in unprecedented ways, and he was a showman. He liked to do things to impress the audience, things that no other violinist did. But the key to understanding my father's tale came from an old scientific report I found that repeated an old story told by Paganini himself. It went like this. Some 200 years ago, Paganini found himself giving regular performances in Lucca, a town in Italy where Napoleon Bonaparte, then the Emperor of France, spent a great deal of time with members of his family. One lady, who was a regular attendee at Paganini's performances, had caught his eye. And as their attraction for one another intensified, Paganini decided to write a composition for her that he would play at an upcoming concert. It was to be called Love Scene, and the notes were to reflect the conversation of 2 lovers. Paganini came up with the idea of removing the middle 2 strings of the violin and playing the composition only on the upper and lower strings, with the low G string representing the man's voice and the high E string the woman's. Paganini described the dialogue between them in this way. Now the strings had to chide, and now to sigh. They had to whisper, to moan, to frisk, to rejoice, and at the end to exult. And at the final reconciliation, the newly united pair perform a pas de deux that closes with a brilliant coda. Paganini's performance of this composition was a great success, and after the concert he received an unusual request. A female member of Napoleon's family, whom Paganini referred to only as the princess, asked if he might write a piece to be performed on just 1 string. Apparently, she was rather sensitive to sound, and compositions on all 4 strings sometimes proved too much for her nerves. Paganini agreed and named the resulting composition for the G string Napoleon, because the emperor's birthday was near. The audience appreciated that song as well. And Paganini became intrigued with the challenge of writing and performing pieces on just the 1 string. Of course, because he was a showman, as Paganini began to introduce 1-string compositions into his repertoire, he would not simply announce them as such. He developed an act in which he would break one string after another by applying excessive force until he was down to the G string, where he would finish the song. He would write the songs with this in mind, with most of the song written to be performed on all four strings, then a section for three, a section for two, and a final section for just the G string. Because the audience had not heard the songs before, this was long before recorded music, of course. They had no idea what they were supposed to sound like. They only knew that they were heavenly. And in the case of one song, Paganini had finished the composition while dealing with three broken strings. Paganini's ability to write and play a beautiful tune on one string of the violin should not be taken lightly. He was a master of the violin, and this was an ability that no other violinist of his time possessed. But the performance was not the magical feat his listeners had believed it to be. It was the product of long, careful practice. One of the major reasons that people believe in the power of innate talent is the apparent existence of natural prodigies. People who, like Paganini, seem to display skills unlike anyone else's, or who exhibit expertise with little or no training. If such natural prodigies do indeed exist, then there must be at least some people who are born with innate abilities that allow them to do things other people cannot. As it happens, I have made it a hobby to investigate the stories of such prodigies, and I can report with confidence that I have never found a convincing case for anyone developing extraordinary abilities without intense, extended practice. My basic approach to understanding prodigies is the same as it is for understanding any expert performer. I ask two simple questions. What is the exact nature of the ability? And what sorts of training made it possible? In 30 years of looking, I have never found an ability that could not be explained by answering these two questions. There are far too many reputed natural prodigies for me to address more than a fraction of them here, and that is not the purpose of this book. But let's look at a few cases just to provide a taste of how seemingly magical abilities can quickly become more believable when examined through the lens of deliberate practice. Mozart and his legend. More than 250 years after his birth, Mozart remains the ultimate example of an inexplicable prodigy, the sort of person who was so accomplished at such a young age that there seems to be no way to explain it other than to assume he was born with something extra. We know from the historical record that at a very young age, Mozart was impressing audiences across Europe with his playing of the harpsichord, clavichord, and the violin. Beginning when Wolfgang was just six, his father took him and his sister on a multi-year tour across Europe. In Munich, Vienna, Prague, Mannheim, Paris, London, Zurich, and another of other cities, the three Mozarts, Wolfgang, his father Leopold, and his sister Maria Anna, played exhibitions for the elites of the day. And, of course, little Wolfgang, his legs dangling from the bench and his hands barely able to reach the keyboard, was the main attraction. The Europeans had never seen anything like him. So his abilities at a young age are inarguable. We must then ask, how did he practice? And can it explain these abilities? Mozart certainly could play the violin and keyboard instruments with a facility that 18th century Europeans were not used to in one so young. But today, when we're accustomed to seeing 5- and 6-year-olds trained in the Suzuki method playing beautifully on the violin and piano, his achievements seem much less wondrous. Indeed, there are YouTube videos of 4-year-olds playing the violin and the piano with amazing facility, better than most adults. Yet we don't immediately assume that these children were born with some superior musical talent. We've seen enough of these prodigies now to know that they have developed their abilities through intense practice beginning at age 2 or earlier. Mozart, of course, did not have the advantage of the Suzuki method, but he did have a father who was every bit as dedicated to raising a musical prodigy as any modern Suzuki parent. Furthermore, as I mentioned in the introduction, not only had Leopold Mozart written a book about teaching music to youngsters and tested out his ideas on Wolfgang's older sister, but Leopold was one of the very first music teachers to push the idea of starting children's lessons at a very young age. Wolfgang probably began his own training before the age of 4. Given what we know now, we can explain how Mozart could have developed his abilities at such a young age without resorting to some sort of exceptional, innate talent. So that explains his precocity as a musician. But his talents as a child composer, another part of his legend, can't be dispatched by pointing to the mundane origins of modern violin prodigies. According to many biographies, he first began composing music when he was 6, and he was 8 when he wrote his first symphony. He wrote an oratorio and several keyboard concertos at 11, and an opera at 12. What was Mozart's talent here, really? What exactly did he do? Once we have answered that question, then we will try to figure out how he did it. First, it's worth noting that music training today is quite different than what Wolfgang's father put him through. Today, Suzuki music teachers focus on one aspect of music, performance on a single instrument, while Leopold Mozart not only taught Wolfgang multiple instruments, he also worked with him on listening to and analyzing music, and on writing music. So from early on, Leopold was pushing Wolfgang to develop his composing skills. More to the point, though, the claims of Mozart composing at 6 and 8 years old are almost certainly overstated. First, we know that the early compositions Wolfgang supposedly wrote are actually in Leopold's handwriting. Leopold claimed that he was just cleaning up young Wolfgang's work, but we have no way of knowing how much of a given composition was Wolfgang's work and how much was that of Leopold, who, remember, was a composer himself, and furthermore, a frustrated musician and composer who had never gotten all of the acclaim he wanted. There are plenty of parents of elementary school children today who get overly involved in their children's science fair projects. It would not be at all surprising if something like that happened with young Wolfgang's compositions, particularly given the fact that Leopold had given up his own career by that time and had hitched his success to that of his son. This seems even more likely given what we know about the piano concertos that Wolfgang composed at 11. Although these were considered original compositions for many years, musicologists eventually realized that they were all based on relatively unknown sonatas written by others. It now seems most likely that Leopold had assigned these to Wolfgang as compositional exercises to get him comfortable with the structure of the piano concerto, and that there is relatively little in them that is original to Wolfgang. Furthermore, the evidence suggests that even on these reworkings of other people's compositions, Wolfgang had a great deal of help from his father. The first serious compositions that we can attribute to Wolfgang Mozart with certainty were written when he was 15 or 16, after more than a decade of serious practice under his father's tutelage. So we have no solid evidence that he did compose any significant music on his own before he was a teenager, and good reason to believe he did not. And when he did unequivocally begin to compose music that was original and sophisticated, he had been training to compose for a decade or so. In short, while there is no doubt that Mozart would become an extraordinary musician and composer, there is no evidence for, and plenty of evidence against, the claim that he was a prodigy whose accomplishments cannot be understood as the result of practice and must therefore be attributed to innate talent. I have found the same thing with every child prodigy I have looked into. A more current example is Mario Lemieux, the Canadian hockey player generally recognized as one of the best of all time. There are various stories, many of them that can be traced back to Lemieux's mother, of how the young Mario took to the ice like a fish to water, skating from the very beginning as if he had been born to it, and showing up older children who had been skating for years. These stories, in turn, have led some to claim that Lemieux is an example of a person who was clearly born with a superior natural talent. However, a little digging into Lemieux's childhood reveals a situation very similar to that of the young Wolfgang Mozart. As I mentioned in Chapter 7, Mario was the third son in a hockey-mad family, and he grew up with his two older brothers teaching him about hockey and skating almost from the time he could walk. The three would play wooden spoon hockey together in the basement, sliding around on their stocking feet, and later their father built a rink in their front yard on which they could practice their hockey. So focused were Mario's parents on encouraging this hockey practice that they would even create stretches of ice in their home, where the boys could skate after it got too dark to skate outside. They did this by bringing piles of snow into the house, packing it down on the floors of the front hallway, dining room, and living room, and keeping the door open so that the house would stay cold. The brothers could then skate from room to icy room, giving a whole new meaning to the term home ice. In short, the evidence is that, like Mozart, Lemieux had lots of practice before people began noticing what a natural talent he had. The Magical High Jumper. Perhaps the most dramatic recent example of a supposed sports prodigy is the high jumper Donald Thomas. His story was told by David Epstein in the book The Sports Gene, and because it is so arresting, it has been retold many times. Here are the basics. Donald Thomas, originally from the Bahamas, was a student at Lindenwood University in Missouri and a member of the junior varsity basketball team. He was playing basketball with a friend who was a high jumper on the track team, and he showed off with some amazing dunks. Later, in the cafeteria, he and his friend were trading good-natured insults, and his friend said to him something to the effect of, "Sure, you can dunk, but I bet you couldn't clear 6'6" in the high jump." That would be a decent jump at the college level, particularly for athletes in the lower division colleges such as Lindenwood. But the best college-level high jumpers regularly clear 7 feet. So Thomas took him up on the dare. The two went over to the university's fieldhouse, where Thomas's friend set up the high jump bar at 6'6". Thomas, wearing his basketball shorts and shoes, cleared it easily. His friend put it up to 6'8". Thomas cleared it. Then his friend put the bar all the way up to 7 feet. When Thomas cleared that as well, his friend grabbed him and took him to see the school's track coach, who agreed to have him join the track team and jump in a meet that was coming up in 2 days. At that meet, still wearing basketball shoes instead of track shoes, Thomas won the competition with a jump of 2.22 meters, or about 7 feet, 3.4 inches, which was a record at Eastern Illinois University, where the meet was held. 2 months later, Thomas competed for the Bahamas in Melbourne, Australia, in the British Commonwealth Games, where he placed fourth with a jump of 2.23 meters. He would later transfer to Auburn University and compete for its track team, and just a year after his gift for high jumping was discovered, he placed first in the World Championships in Athletics in Osaka, Japan, with a jump of 2.35 meters, or nearly 7 feet, 8.6 inches. In his book, Epstein dramatized Thomas's accomplishments by comparing him with Stefan Holm of Sweden, who had been training rigorously on the high jump ever since he was a kid and had logged more than 20,000 hours of practice. Yet, at the 2007 World Championships in Athletics, he was beaten by Thomas, who Epstein estimated had only a few hundred hours of training. There is clearly a fascination with this type of story, where someone seems to have come out of nowhere to excel as some sort of naturally gifted performer. And these days, because the 10,000-hour rule has become so well known, the stories are often written as proof that this rule is wrong. Donald Thomas, or someone else, shows us that it is indeed possible to become the best in the world without practicing that much, if only you were born with the right genes. I get it. People want to believe that there is magic in life, that not everything has to abide by the staid, boring rules of the real world. And what could be more magical than being born with some incredible ability that doesn't require hard work or discipline to develop? There is an entire comic book industry built on that premise, that sometimes something magical happens, and you suddenly acquire incredible powers. Unbeknownst to you, you were actually born on the planet Krypton and you can fly, or you were bitten by a radioactive spider and you can cling to walls, or you were exposed to cosmic radiation and now you can become invisible. But my decades of research in the areas of expertise have convinced me that there is no magic. By examining the case of someone with exceptional abilities through the lens of those two earlier questions I posed, what is the talent? What practice led to the talent? You can pull back the curtain and find what is really going on. Consider Thomas's story. There is actually little or nothing about his background that we know other than what has come from him directly, which has been very limited. So it is difficult to track down exactly what sorts of training he might have had. But we do know a few things. First, Thomas himself told an interviewer that he had competed in the high jump in at least one intramural meet in high school, and had jumped something like 6'2", 6'4", nothing memorable. So we know that he had at least competed in the high jump before. And if he was competing on his high school team, he almost certainly got some training. And Thomas is being a bit modest when he says the jump was nothing memorable. While 6'4" is by no means a great jump in high school, it is a good one. Of course, it might be possible that Thomas had no training whatsoever in high school, and simply went out one time and jumped 6'4" without practice, just like he jumped 7 feet without practice in college. The problem with this scenario is that we actually have photos of Thomas clearing the bar in the first college meet, and it is not the technique of someone who has never trained in the high jump. Thomas is clearly using the Fosbury flop, named for the American high jumper Dick Fosbury, who popularized it in the 1960s. The flop is a highly counterintuitive way to get over the bar. You run at the bar in a curving path so that as you reach the point directly in front of the bar, your back is facing it, and then you jump up and arch backward over the bar, throwing your feet up at the last minute so as not to knock the bar down. It is not enough to simply have a lot of spring in your legs. You have to use just the right technique to execute this jump. No one performs the Fosbury flop effectively without extended practice. So, although we don't know anything explicitly about Thomas's training before that day in the Lindenwood Fieldhouse, we can be sure that he spent quite a few hours learning that technique to the point that he could clear something like 6'2", 6'4". The second thing we know is that Thomas had an incredible jumping ability when dunking. There are videos of him dunking a basketball after taking off from the free throw line, 15 feet from the goal, and flying over a couple of people on his way to the rim. Again, while we have no information on how much practice Thomas put into his dunking, we can be certain he worked hard to develop that spring in his legs. Dunking was clearly something that he was proud of, so it would be strange if he had not worked hard on it. So again, it is circumstantial, but it seems clear that Thomas practiced diligently on his ability to jump high on his dunks. And as it happens, the sort of jumping technique you use in dunking, which involves taking several steps and then jumping off of one foot, is very similar to what is used in the high jump. By training his dunking ability, Thomas was also training for the high jump. A 2011 study shows that the ability to jump off of one leg is closely correlated with the height of a high jump among skilled high jumpers. Third, it's worth noting that Thomas is 6'2", which is a good, if not ideal, height for high jumping. As I mentioned earlier, the only two areas where we know for certain that genetics affects sports performance are height and body size. Stefan Holm, the Swedish high jumper whom Thomas defeated in the 2007 World Championships, is only 5'11", extremely short for a high jumper. Holm had to train extra hard to make up for this deficit. Thomas was genetically gifted with a good body size for the high jump. So when you put all this together, Thomas's feat no longer seems quite so magical. Impressive, yes, but not magical. Thomas had almost certainly trained in the high jump previously, at least enough to develop a good Fosbury flop, and he had developed his ability to jump high off of one foot through his practice dunking, an unusual approach to training for the high jump, but in Thomas's case at least, an effective one. And we have one more bit of evidence. As of 2015, Thomas had been competing for 9 years in the high jump. He has been training under coaches who know how to get the most out of an athlete. If he had indeed been nothing but raw potential in 2006, we should have seen some phenomenal growth from him since he started training rigorously. Indeed, in the first year or so after he was discovered, people were predicting that his innate talent meant that he must surely develop to the point that he would break the world record, which is 2.45 meters, or 8.04 feet. But he hasn't come close. His best jump in competition came in that 2007 World Championships in Athletics, when he cleared 2.35 meters. He has approached that height a few times since, but has never equaled it. In the 2014 Commonwealth Games, he jumped 2.21 meters, less than he was able to jump 8 years earlier in the 2006 Commonwealth Games, when he first made a name for himself. The most obvious conclusion to draw from this is that when Thomas first competed in college in 2006, he had already had a great deal of training, both high jump training and training to jump higher for dunking. So it was difficult for further training to make a big difference. If he had indeed never trained, there should have been much more improvement. Savants. Besides apparent prodigies like Mozart or Donald Thomas, there is one other group of people who are often claimed to exhibit extraordinary abilities that seem to have appeared almost as if by magic. And these are people with savant syndrome. The abilities of these savants, as they are now called, generally arise in very specific areas. Some play a musical instrument, and often have thousands of different pieces of music memorized, and can sometimes play a new piece of music after hearing it once. Others can paint, or sculpt, or do other sorts of art, often producing incredibly detailed works. Some do arithmetic calculations, such as multiplying two large numbers in their heads. Still others do calendar calculations, such as stating what day of the week October 12, 25,077 will be, a Sunday. What makes these abilities particularly noteworthy is that most of these savants are otherwise mentally challenged in one way or another. Some perform extremely poorly on IQ tests, while others are severely autistic and can barely interact with other people. The appearance of these striking abilities in people who otherwise struggle to function in the world is what makes the savant syndrome so intriguing, and also what makes it seem as if these abilities must have appeared without the normal sort of practice that we generally expect. Again, the best approach to take in understanding these abilities is to first understand exactly what they are, and then to look for the sorts of practice that could explain them. Research that has taken that approach indicates that savants are not the recipients of some miraculous talent. Instead, they have worked for it, just like anyone else. Francesca Appé and Pedro Vital, two researchers at King's College London, compared autistic children who developed savant-like abilities with autistic children who did not develop such abilities. They found that the autistic savants are much more likely than the non-savants to be very detail-oriented and prone to repetitive behaviors. When something captures their attention, they will focus on it to the exclusion of everything else around them, retreating into their own worlds. These particular autistic people are more likely to practice obsessively a musical piece or memorize a collection of phone numbers, and thus are likely to develop skills in those areas in the same way that people engaging in purposeful or deliberate practice do. One of the best examples of this is Donnie, an autistic savant who is the fastest, most accurate calendar calculator who has ever been tested. Donnie can provide the day of the week for a particular date within a second of hearing the date, and he is almost invariably correct. Mark Thieu of the University of Groningen in the Netherlands has been studying Donnie for a number of years, and Thieu's research gives us an unprecedented window into the mind of an autistic savant. Donnie is addicted to dates, Thieu has said. The first thing that Donnie does when he meets someone is to ask for the person's birthday. He is constantly thinking about dates and repeating dates to himself. He has memorized all 14 possible yearly calendars. That is, the 7 normal year calendars, in which January 1st is a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Saturday, and the corresponding leap year calendars. And he has developed ways to quickly calculate which of those 14 possible calendars applies to any given year. When asked which day of the week a particular date will fall on, Donnie focuses first on the year in order to figure out which of the 14 calendars to use. And he then refers to that mental calendar to determine the day of the week for the date in question. In short, Donnie possesses a highly developed skill that is the result of years of obsessive study, but no sign of a miraculous innate talent. In the late 1960s, a psychologist named Barnett Addis set out to see if he could train someone of normal intelligence to do the same sorts of calendar calculations that savants do. In particular, he had been studying how two calendar-calculating twins performed their feats. The twins, who each had an IQ in the 60 to 70 range, were able to provide the days of the week for dates out to the year AD 132,470, within an average of 6 seconds. Addis found that the twins' method seemed to involve finding an equivalent year between 1600 and 2000, and then adding up numbers that corresponded to the day of the month, the year, and the century. With this understanding, Addis then trained a graduate student in that method to see if it actually worked. In just 16 practice sessions, the graduate student was able to calculate just as fast as either of the twins. Most interestingly, the graduate student took different amounts of time to generate the weekday, depending on the amount of calculation required. His pattern of response times matched those of the best twin, suggesting to Addis that the two of them were indeed getting their answers via similar cognitive processes. The lesson here is that there is clearly nothing magical about Donnie's or any other savant's calendar calculation abilities. Donnie developed his abilities over years of working with and thinking about dates, reaching the point where he knows each of the 14 different calendars as well as you or I know our phone numbers. And he has developed his own technique, which in this case researchers still have not completely understood, for determining which calendar to use for which year. It is nothing that a motivated college student in a psychology experiment could not do. We do not yet know exactly how other savants do what they do, and how they have developed their particular skills. Savants are generally hard to communicate with or to question about their methods. But as I noted in a 1988 review, studies of savants' abilities indicate that these are primarily acquired skills, which in turn implies that the savants develop those abilities in ways that are very similar to how other experts do it. That is, they practice in a way that engages their brain's adaptability, which in turn changes their brains in ways that lead to their extraordinary abilities. More recent case studies of savants' brains have been consistent with this idea. The anti-prodigies. I could keep going with more analyses of prodigies and savants, but it would just be more of the same. The bottom line is that every time you look closely into such a case, you find that the extraordinary abilities are the product of much practice and training. Prodigies and savants don't give us any reason to believe that some people are born with natural abilities in one field or another. But what about the flip side of prodigies? What about people who seem to have been born without any talent whatsoever in this field or that? On an individual level, this is a very difficult issue to address, since it can be hard to figure out exactly why a particular person didn't accomplish something. Was it for lack of effort, lack of adequate teaching, or lack of innate talent? You can't always tell. But consider the following cases. About 1/6 of all American adults believe they can't sing. They can't carry a tune in a bucket. They couldn't hit a note if you gave them a tennis racket. And generally speaking, these people aren't very happy about it. If you talk to music teachers or the few researchers who study non-singers, they will tell you that these musically challenged sorts would like things to be different. At the very least, they'd like to be able to sing Happy Birthday without frightening people. They may even daydream about karaoke and bringing the house down with their versions of My Way or Baby One More Time. But somewhere along the way, someone convinced them that they couldn't sing. Interviews have found that it was usually some sort of authority figure. A parent, an older sibling, a music teacher, maybe a peer they admired. And it usually came at some defining and often painful moment that they still remember quite well as adults. Most often they were told they were tone deaf. And so, believing that they just weren't born to sing, they gave up. Now, the term tone deaf actually has a very specific meaning. It means you can't tell the difference between one musical note and another. For example, if someone hits a C note on the piano and then a D note, a tone-deaf person can't tell the difference. And, of course, if you can't tell one note from the next, it would certainly be impossible to carry a tune, which is just a series of notes strung together. It would be like trying to paint a sunset when you can't tell red from yellow from blue. Some people are indeed born tone-deaf. The medical condition is known as congenital amusia. But here's the twist. It is exceedingly rare. It is so rare that the discovery of a woman with this condition rated an article in a major scientific journal. She had no obvious brain damage or defects, had normal hearing and intelligence, and yet she could not tell the difference between a simple melody she had already heard and a new one she had never heard before. Interestingly enough, she also had trouble distinguishing different musical rhythms. This woman, no matter how hard she tried, would never be able to carry a tune. But that is not the case for most people. The major obstacle that people who believe they can't sing must overcome is that belief itself. Various researchers have studied this issue, and there is no evidence that large numbers of people are born without the innate ability to sing. Indeed, there are some cultures, such as the Anang Ibibio of Nigeria, where everyone is expected to sing, everyone is taught to sing, and everyone can sing. In our culture, the reason that most non-singers cannot sing is simply that they never practiced in a way that led them to develop the ability to sing. Could the same thing be true about a subject like math? There is perhaps no area in which more people will tell you, "I am no good in." A large percentage of students, particularly in the United States, leave high school with the conviction that they just do not have the genetic endowment to do any math more complicated than addition, subtraction, and perhaps multiplication. But a number of successful efforts have shown that pretty much any child can learn math if it is taught in the right way. Perhaps the most intriguing of these efforts is a curriculum called Jump Math, developed by John Mitton, a Canadian mathematician. The program uses the basic principles found in deliberate practice, breaking learning down into a series of well-specified skills, designing exercises to teach each of those skills in the correct order, and using feedback to monitor progress. According to teachers who have used the curriculum, this approach has allowed them to teach the relevant math skills to essentially every student, with no one left behind. JUMP was evaluated in a randomized control trial in Ontario with 29 teachers and approximately 300 fifth grade students, and after 5 months, the students in the JUMP classes showed more than twice as much progress as the others in understanding mathematical concepts as measured by standardized tests. Unfortunately, the results of the trial have not appeared in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, so it is hard to judge them objectively, and we will need to see the results reproduced in other school districts before we can trust them completely. But the results agree with what I have observed generally in a variety of fields, not just singing and math, but writing, drawing, tennis, golf, gardening, and a variety of games, such as Scrabble and crossword solving. People do not stop learning and improving because they have reached some innate limits on their performance. They stop learning and improving because, for whatever reasons, they stopped practicing or never started. There is no evidence that any otherwise normal people are born without the innate talent to sing or do math or perform any other skill. Practice versus talent in chess. Think back to when you were a kid, and you were just starting to learn to play the piano, or throw a baseball, or draw something. Or maybe think about how it felt when you were just a little further along. You'd been playing soccer for 6 months, and it was just starting to make sense. Or you had joined the chess club a year earlier, and you had finally gotten a basic command of the game. Or you had figured out addition and subtraction and multiplication, and then your teacher was throwing long division at you. In all of these cases, when you looked around, you would have noticed that some of your friends or classmates or peers were doing better than others, and some were doing worse. There are always obvious differences in how quickly different people pick something up. Some just seem to have an easier time playing a musical instrument. Some just seem to be natural athletes. Some just seem to be naturally good with numbers, and so on. And because we see such differences in beginners, it's natural to assume that those differences will persist, that the same people who did so well in the beginnings will continue to breeze through later on. These lucky people, we imagine, were born with innate talents that smooth the way and lead them to excel. This is an understandable result of observing the beginning of the journey and concluding that the rest of the journey will be similar. It is also wrong. Once we take a look at the entire journey, from beginner to expert, we develop a very different understanding of how people learn and improve and what it takes to excel. Perhaps the best example we have of this comes from chess. In the popular imagination, great skill in chess is intimately tied to tremendous logic and intellect. If an author or screenwriter wishes to signal that a character is particularly brilliant, that character will be seated at a chessboard and will checkmate his or her opponent with the proper savoir-faire. Even better, this genius will come across a game already in progress and, after glancing at the board for a second or two, point out the winning line of play. Quite often, the chess player is a quirky but brilliant detective, or perhaps the equally quirky and almost equally brilliant criminal mastermind, or preferably both, so that the opponents can face each other across the board, matching wits and trading witticisms. Sometimes, as in the climactic scene in the 2011 movie A Game of Shadows with Sherlock Holmes and Professor Moriarty, the two of them end up ignoring the chessboard altogether and just spit out their moves at each other like two boxers, feinting and jabbing, until one lands the knockout punch. But no matter the circumstances, the message is always the same. A mastery of chess signals the sort of deep intelligence that only a few are fortunate enough to be born with. And conversely, playing chess brilliantly demands a brilliant mind. And if you examine chess-playing ability in children who are just learning to play, those with higher IQs do indeed become better players faster. But that is just the beginning of the story. And it is the end of the story that truly tells the tale. Over the years, many researchers have examined the connection between intelligence and chess-playing ability. Some of the earliest work was done in the 1890s by Alfred Binet, the father of intelligence testing, who studied chess players mainly in an attempt to understand what sort of memory was required to play blindfold chess. Binet developed his IQ test as a method of identifying students who had problems doing well in school, and indeed he succeeded, as IQ tests are very much correlated with academic success. But since Binet's time, many researchers have argued that the IQ test measures general abilities that are correlated with success in virtually any domain, such as music and chess. These researchers thus believe that IQ tests measure some sort of general innate intelligence. Others disagree, however, and argue that IQ is best thought of not as innate intelligence, but rather simply as what IQ tests measure, which can include such things as knowledge about relatively rare words and acquired skills in mathematics. Without delving deeply into that debate, I will just say that I think it is best not to equate IQ with innate intelligence, but simply to stick with the facts and think of IQ as some cognitive factor measured by IQ tests that has been shown to predict certain things, such as success in school. Since the 1970s, a growing number of researchers have been following in Binet's footsteps and trying to understand how chess players think and what makes a good chess player. One of the most enlightening of these studies was carried out in 2006 by three British researchers, Merim Bilalich and Peter McLeod of Oxford University, and Fernand Gobet of Brunel University. For reasons that we will get to in a moment, the three chose to study not grandmasters, but rather a collection of chess-playing school children, recruiting 57 kids from chess clubs in primary and secondary schools. The young chess players were generally between 9 and 13 years old, and they had been playing the game for an average of about 4 years. Some of them were very good enough to easily beat the average adult who plays in chess tournaments, and some were not very good at all. 44 of the 57 were boys. The goal of the study was to examine what role, if any, IQ plays in how good a chess player someone can become. This is a question that quite a few psychologists had already examined. And, as the three researchers noted in the paper that they published reporting their results, the issue had been rather unsettled. For example, some research had found a relationship between IQ and chess-playing ability, as well as between tests measuring visuospatial abilities and chess skill. Neither would seem particularly surprising, given the general view that chess requires higher-than-normal intelligence, and given that visuospatial abilities seem to be particularly important to chess, since chess players must be able to visualize chess positions and the movements of the pieces as they examine potential lines of play. But these studies were done in young chess players, and while they found that these young players did have higher-than-average IQ scores, there was no clear relationship between IQ and how good a particular player was. By contrast, studies done in adults have generally found adult chess players to have no better visuospatial abilities than normal non-chess-playing adults. Research has also shown that skilled adult chess players, even grandmasters, do not have systematically higher IQs than other adults with similar levels of education. Nor is there any correlation between the IQs of highly skilled chess players and their chess ratings. As strange as it seems to those of us who have grown up with the tortured but brilliant fictional characters who excel at chess, all of the evidence says that higher intelligence is not correlated with better chess playing among adults. Even stranger is the case of Go, which has often been referred to as the Asian version of chess. It is played by two people who alternately place their stones, white for one player, black for the other, on one of the intersecting points on the 19x19 grid that makes up the board. The goal is to surround and capture the other player's stones, and the winner is the one who controls the larger area of the board at the end of the game. While there is only one type of piece and only one type of move, putting a stone on an intersection point, the game is actually more complex than chess, in the sense that there are far more different possible games that can be played, and indeed it has proved far more challenging than chess to develop software to play the game well. Unlike the best chess-playing computer programs, which can consistently beat chess grandmasters, the best Go programs, at least as this is written in 2015, cannot stand up to top-ranked Go players. Thus, as with chess, you might assume that Go masters must have high IQs or perhaps exceptional visuospatial skills. But again, you would be wrong. Recent studies of Go masters have found that their average IQ is, if anything, below average. Two separate studies of Korean Go experts found an average IQ of about 93, compared with control groups of non-Go-playing Koreans matched for sex and age, which had an average IQ around 100. While the numbers of Go masters in the two studies were small enough that the below-average IQs could have been just statistical flukes, it is clear that Go masters, on average, score no higher on IQ tests than people in the general population. Against this background, the three British researchers set out to resolve the conflicting results on chess players. Does a higher intelligence, that is, a higher IQ score, help one develop a better chess game or not? The researchers' plan was to do a study that took into account both intelligence and practice time. Earlier studies had looked at one or the other, but not both together. Bilalic and his colleagues set out to learn as much as they could about their group of 57 young chess players. They measured various aspects of their intelligence, not just their IQ and their spatial intelligence, but their memory, verbal intelligence, and speed of processing. They asked the children about when they'd started to play and how many hours they spent practicing. They also asked the kids to keep practice diaries for about 6 months, in which they recorded the amount of time they spent practicing each day. One weakness of the study is that much of the practice time was actually spent playing chess games against other members of their chess clubs rather than in solitary practice, and the researchers did not distinguish between the two types of practice. Still, the measures offered a reasonable estimate of how much effort each child had put into developing his or her game. Finally, the researchers assessed the kids' chess skills by giving them chess problems to solve, and by briefly showing them chessboards with the pieces arranged in a position from the middle of a game, and asking them to reconstruct the boards from memory. A few of the subjects were regularly participating in tournaments, and in these cases, the researchers also had their chess ratings to work with. When the researchers analyzed all their data, they found results similar to those seen by other researchers. The amount of chess practice that the children had done was the biggest factor in explaining how well they played chess, with more practice being correlated with better scores on the various measures of chess skill. A smaller but still significant factor was intelligence, with higher IQ being related to better chess skills. Surprisingly, visuospatial intelligence wasn't the most important factor, but rather memory and processing speed were. Looking at all their evidence, the researchers concluded that in children of this age, practice is the key factor in success, although innate intelligence, or IQ, still plays a role. The picture changed dramatically, however, when the researchers looked at only the elite players in the group. These were 23 children, all boys, who were regularly playing in tournaments on the local, national, and sometimes international levels. They had an average chess rating of 1603, with the highest being 1835 and the lowest 1390. In short, these kids were already quite good at chess. The average chess rating for everyone who plays in chess tournaments, both adults and children, is about 1500, which means that most of the boys in the elite group were above that average, and even the worst of them would have had little trouble checkmating a competent adult player. Among these 23 elite players, the amount of practice was still the major factor in determining their chess skills, but intelligence played no noticeable role. While the elite group did have a somewhat higher average IQ than the average IQ for the entire group of 57, the players in the elite group with lower IQs were, on average, slightly better players than those in the elite group with higher IQs. Stop and digest that for a moment. Among these young elite chess players, not only was a higher IQ no advantage, but it seemed to put them at a slight disadvantage. The reason, the researchers found, was that the elite players with the lower IQs tended to practice more, which improved their chess game to the point that they played better than the high IQ elite players. This study goes a long way toward explaining the apparent contradiction between the earlier studies, which had found that IQ was linked with greater chess skill in young players, but not in adult tournament players and not in masters or grandmasters. And this explanation is very important to us because it applies not just to chess players, but to the development of any skill. When children are just beginning to learn chess, their intelligence, that is, their performance on IQ tests, plays a role in how quickly they can learn the game and reach a certain minimal level of competence. Kids with higher IQ scores generally find it easier to learn and remember rules and to develop and carry out strategies. All of these things give them an advantage in the early stages of learning the game, when one plays by abstract thinking applied directly to the pieces on the board. This type of learning is not all that different from the learning that goes on in schools, which was the target of Binet's original project, developing IQ tests. But we know that as children or adults study and learn the game, they develop sets of mental representations, in essence, mental shortcuts that give them both a superior memory for the sorts of chess positions found in a game and an ability to quickly zero in on appropriate moves in a given situation. It seems quite likely that these superior mental representations allow them to play the game more quickly and powerfully. Now, when they see a certain arrangement of pieces, they don't have to carefully figure out which piece is attacking or could attack every other piece.